The Word of Mouth podcast from NHPR is made possible with support from you, our subscribers.
And from Heinemann, a provider of resources written by real teachers for real classrooms. Heinemann values teachers as decision makers and students as curious learners. Discover the path to lifelong professional learning at Heinemann.com. Heinemann, dedicated to teachers.
This is Word of Mouth. I'm Erica Janik. Today, we have two stories about very different ambitions. One, the drive to sculpt your body, and the other, a drive to sculpt legislation. Up first, a story from Todd Bookman. Every subculture has its own language, its unique set of heroes and myths and rituals. The sport of bodybuilding is no exception to that. NHPR reporter Todd Bookman followed one amateur bodybuilder as he prepared for his first competition.
By some counts, there are more than 600 different muscles in the human body. Some say 700, others put the number at 800. Muscles can be wide or flat. They can be shaped like triangles or diamonds or circles. Muscles get injured, they get torn, they get tired, they can be puny. Or they can be like John McClane's muscles.
What I'm doing right now is I hold poses in between sets. Because when you do that, you don't shake on stage.
John McClane is deep in training for an amateur bodybuilding competition. In case this isn't your sport of choice, bodybuilders lift weights to grow and sculpt their muscles. But when they compete on stage, they're judged by their posing and flexing. They don't lift anything. John's day job is as a personal trainer at the YMCA in Exeter. It's not uncommon for him to put in his 9-to-5 and then spend a few more hours at the gym afterwards. The clapping of iron plates, the whirring of treadmills, they're the gym rat's soundtrack, John's white noise. Some people come here to train for other sports, but this is his sport.
I don't know the jack about the Patriots. I don't know jack about baseball. But you want to know who won the Mr. Olympia in 1987, I can tell you who did it.
Lee Haney, by the way, not exactly a household name. Bodybuilding as a professional sport has never really broken through, never dominated the headlines, with perhaps Arnold Schwarzenegger as a lone exception, the Austrian oak.
The greatest feeling you can get in a gym, or the most satisfying feeling you can get in the gym, is the pump. Let's say you train your biceps. Blood is rushing into your muscles, and that's what we call the pump. Your muscles get a really tight feeling.
Schwarzenegger, mid-1970s, was the ultimate alpha male. Huge, swaggering, confident, all kinds of pumped up. John approaches the sport with a different playbook.
Anyone who's like super macho, the first thing they care about is throwing up as much weight as they can. And yeah, no, first thing you got to do if you're going to get anywhere is check your ego at the door.
But you understand why, I mean, from an outsider's perspective, like I can't think of anything more egotistical than standing on a stage showing your muscles off.
That's because you're looking at it from an outsider's standpoint. All right, so don't look at it from I'm up on stage showing my muscles off. Look at it as I've taken the time to shape and sculpt my body into a piece of moving art. And that's really what it is. I mean, you're essentially like a moving statue. So like Michelangelo's David or something like that, and that's what you're presenting. You're not some big rugged dude getting up there going, look at my chest, it's huge. No, you're a guy who's flowing and you're presenting art.
John is not the biggest, ruggedest dude. He's about 5'7", square-jawed with blonde hair. He got into lifting in high school and began following bodybuilding in college. In 2008, he started prepping for a bodybuilding tournament, but he was dealing with insomnia at the time. His body just couldn't handle the training. The sleep issue stayed with him for nearly a decade before he got on the right medication. It sounds bad. John doesn't like to talk about it. But today, he's feeling and sleeping a lot better. So at the age of 37, he's going to compete in his first bodybuilding competition, the Granite State Open. It's the same tournament he started to train for in 2008.
My family's also a huge support team for this, because they've seen me go through a lot of struggles, and we've kind of gone through a lot together. So, yeah, I'm what I'm doing right here. This is a dream I've had since I was in my early 20s. So any sacrifice seems like nothing, you know?
Bodybuilding puts a lot of stress on the body. It's also, obviously, a lot of time in the gym, and the diet is nuts. We'll hear about that in a minute. It's not all sacrifice, though. Like lots of athletic endeavors, like lots of crafts or hobbies, the repetition and singular focus can turn into something relaxing.
I call it moving meditation, honestly, is what weight training and training period is like, because you could be having the worst day ever, then you hit a really good workout, and then you just feel...
After finishing an hour of weights, today it was biceps, back, and abs, he gets ready to do some posing practice in the group exercise room at the Y. Just having muscles isn't enough. Remember, you are presenting art. And what do bodybuilders wear to present that art?
Just describe to me what you have on right now.
What do I have on? I have on a banana hammock, is what these are kind of called. What is that? That means you can pretty much see everything short of my bits and pieces. So, yeah.
By the way, the exercise room has mirrors for walls. Turn away from the bits, and their reflection still finds you, like Mona Lisa's eyes. On competition day, John and every person in his category will get brought onto stage twice. First time, the entire group will come out for what are called comparisons. Side by side, the athletes will go through a series of poses that highlight different muscle groups, lats, biceps, quads. The second time athletes go on stage, they do it alone. They get to perform a choreographed posing routine set to music. John has chosen the 1986 song Your Love by British rockers The Outfield. Why, you ask? Well, for starters, it's important for your song to be unique. If everyone performs to Eye of the Tiger, nobody will stand out for the judges. Odds are, Your Love will be his alone. Second, John is a big fan of 1980s-era bodybuilders. To him, it was the sport's golden age. The physiques weren't quite as ballooned as today. The posing was better. He starts his routine with a side flex before turning his back to the audience. Then he pinches his back muscles to the beat. His right leg is spiked, highlighting his hamstring and calf muscle. John then spins to the side, pumping his right arm before sliding into a classic front double bicep flex. At this point, his face explodes into a smile. It's meant to show the audience, in this case just me, that he's in total control of his muscles, that this abnormal physique is perfectly normal for him.
That's the first thing I do psychologically is I take myself out of it. And the guy that looks at me in the mirror and smiles back is who you become for a minute. For 1 minute, 60 seconds, you become that guy who's full of confidence, that individual who's just like overflowing with just, I got this, I'm the greatest, you know, like I'm, and that's not you, like that's not me, like, you know, that's not the type of person I am, but that's what you have to be for that 60 seconds.
You become something else as a bodybuilder, someone else. It's not quite like playing a character or a role, but more like walking around inside a fantasy version of yourself. 60 seconds in a costume of muscles and veins. Then you're back to being John McClain again. Just before the gym closes, another personal trainer here, a guy named Rome Bello, joins us. Rome is also a competitive bodybuilder. He's been helping John fine-tune his routine and poses.
He looks ripped, but so is everybody else going into the show.
Yeah.
Rome barks out what are called the mandatory poses, and John follows along. Lat spread, side tricep, flex, kid.
You know, as a judge, they're going to be looking at his legs, his nice shoulders, you know, his abs, and his lats, which should be fanned out a little bit more here. There you go. You know, and they're going to be looking at a lot of this right here, which is looking great. So when he gets nice and tan, you're really going to see a lot of his lines.
When he gets nice and tanned. Michelangelo's David might be white stone, but bodybuilders tend to go with a darker hue. Nearly all competitors get spray tans before going on stage, even people with naturally dark skin. The bronzer helps create an even skin tone. It covers up stretch marks, and it counteracts the washout effect that happens under bright stage lights. Since this is John's first competition, he's decided to do a trial run a few weeks in advance. He's booked an evening tanning appointment with Ryan Healy in Manchester. The GPS leads me to a funeral home parking lot.
I am a licensed funeral director and embalmer. Actually, my father owns the funeral home here, and this, I just started bodybuilding and I got a competition spray tan and I said, this is amazing. But yeah, full time I'm a funeral director and this is my side hobby.
Ryan operates Golden Standard spray tans out of a building adjacent to her family's funeral home. All her equipment and oils are neatly arranged in a side office. John heads to the bathroom to undress.
We can't have any tan lines. So they actually we just kind of cover up what we can.
What do you cover it up with?
Well, you would use like a sock or...
Gym sock.
Yeah, yeah.
There's not a special sock.
No, just a sock.
Bodybuilders tend to favor an industrial strength tan. This is far more bronzer than a bride-to-be may choose. 5 to 6 coats.
All right, here we go. So you can spin around. I'll start with your back.
Healy uses an air gun to spray on a base coat. Within seconds, John changes from, by his own description, whiter than a fish's belly, to something more, well...
Different colors have different shades, but I guess you would call this like a mahogany brown. Mahogany.
The effect is immediate. Mahogany John is instantly more muscular, more defined. That effect will swirl down the drain tonight after he showers, but with it on, he's one more step closer to being that guy on stage that he needs to be, the confident sculpture. Confident sculpture's got to eat, and outside in the funeral home parking lot, John zips open a cooler. Inside are neat stacks of glass Tupperware. John's dad, Gene, who came along for the ride tonight, seems to get a kick out of this part.
Meals do you eat a day?
I eat 7 meals a day, literally.
But if you saw what he ate, you would cry.
That is true. Yep.
Breakfast for John consists of a protein shake and 0.25 ounces of peanuts. 2 hours later, breakfast number two.
It's about 4.85 ounces of brown rice pasta, 2/3 a cup of all whites, which is egg white substitute, which is also equals 5 egg whites and a whole egg. And then after that, 2 hours later, I'll do like, usually it's like lunch, which is like 4 ounces of chicken, a salad with a quarter cup of red peppers and 0.25 ounces of peanuts. Then 2 hours later,
we're counting peanuts. He's literally like counting peanuts.
Oh, I'm natural, man. That's what it takes to do this.
By natural, John means he's not a steroid user. Everyone in this upcoming competition will need to pass a drug test. So to put on muscle, you need to eat just tons and tons of protein. The meal plan varies, but some days, John is downing as much as 300 grams of protein. That's more than 5 times what the average male consumes. Frankly, it sounds like a gastrointestinal nightmare. Chicken, lean steak, salad, repeat. It's disciplined, it's boring, no cheat days.
I'm rigid, what can I say? That's why this is not, let's try this today. Yeah, no. Diet matches training matches goal. That's always how it's been, that's always how it's gonna be.
John spends his days surrounded by motivational posters at the gym. They seem to have seeped into his subconscious. But if you're going to strut out on stage with the belief that your body looks better than somebody else's body, that your delts and pecs and glutes are more sculpted than someone else's delts, pecs, glutes, you better not be bluffing. If you second-guess your swole, so could the judges.
There must be some nerves, though, right?
Not really. No.
Come on, you got it. You're kidding me.
No, I'm not. I practiced. I've dieted, dude. I've killed myself to do this. I should have done this 10 years ago. Like 10 years ago, that's when I was originally gonna do this exact same show. It's been long enough. I'm not nervous.
The day of the 24th annual Granite State Open, it's pouring rain. The event is held inside the Dover High School auditorium.
This new auditorium is bigger than the one we had, so it doesn't look like there's a lot of people, but there really is. So thank you all for being here today.
The venue will not see its capacity tested today. The empty seats are a good reminder that this sport is for practically no one except the athletes who love it. First up, the female a cappella group The Funky Divas perform the national anthem. Meanwhile, backstage, 84 athletes from across New England are getting in a final pump. There are a bunch of different categories in this day-long competition. Different age groups, couples posing, bikini judging. I'm not sure why, but tunes from the Rat Pack era seem to be in heavy rotation during the early rounds.
As long as there's the two of you, you've got the world, and all its chunks.
John is competing in what's called the male novice category. It's for athletes making their bodybuilding debut.
Okay, next on stage.
It's still pretty early in the afternoon. John and three other chiseled men walk out in their Speedos. John is stage right wearing royal blue. His tan looks great. The judges, sitting front and center, call out a series of posing commands.
Same position, front lat spread.
Oh, let's see that point. Woo!
Muscles and veins seem to come alive under the surface. Weird muscles, too. Things in your thigh you probably didn't know were there. John says bodybuilding is presenting the body as art, but it's also science. It's a medical school textbook open to the page on muscularity. Having myself never judged a bodybuilding competition, it's hard to know exactly what separates the Hulks from the Hulks. John says the judging usually comes down to a few things: symmetry and proportion, conditioning, and presentation. Judges look to see if the muscle groups are built up equally. Are they well-defined with little or no fat? And is the athlete presenting with grace? The biggest athlete doesn't always win, though being biggest can help. From my seat in the seventh row, John and his competitors all look pretty good. Though it's clear right away that the competitor third from the left just seems massive, bigger and leaner than everyone else. Let's slot him in as the favorite.
Great, gentlemen, thank you, and we'll see you later tonight.
After the comparison round is over, John and the others walk off stage. There's now a long gap before the individual posing routines begin. I find John eating a rice cake backstage. He's pleased with how the first part went. He transformed into the person he thinks he needs to be.
I got up there and I was like, and then I just closed my eyes and I saw him, that guy. He's up there and he's just larger than life. And he's smiling and he's posing and he looks awesome. And he's like that dude who's always been in the mirror or whatever, who you're like, who's that dude? You know, like, that ain't me. You know, like, what's he doing? Like, yeah. And I saw that guy just out there doing the routine, doing everything. And I walked into him. And that's what I did.
He's not making perfect sense, but you get the idea. For someone whose showmanship doesn't come naturally for, he figured out how to put on a good show. It's still a few more hours before the individual posing routines kick off. Because of some sort of administrative glitch, John wasn't on the roster when he checked in this morning. So he was assigned number 84. 84 out of 84. He'll go last this evening.
This is John Blake. From Exeter, New Hampshire, and he's a personal trainer. He'd like to thank his family and coaches for their support.
John walks out on stage, turns his back, hits his mark. Something's wrong. The sound system worked fine for the previous 83 competitors, but now his song is playing too slow. Some kind of glitch. John is understandably thrown off. He yells out, "Speed it up," but there's no fix. He works through his routine in slow motion, but it's a train wreck. He tries to smile through gritted teeth. When the trophies are awarded later on in the night, John's is the smallest in his category.
In fourth place, we have Tom McLean, number 84.
John McLean, not Tom McLean. Glitch number three, but who's counting? So the competition didn't turn out exactly as he'd hoped for. The winner was the biggest guy. I'm not sure the music necessarily mattered in the long run. But a few weeks later, back at the gym, it's still on his mind.
Did it throw you off, the music?
Yeah. It did, and I'm not going to lie, I was a little pissed. All right, I was pissed. Who am I kidding? I was. I mean, I'd been in here until closing every night. You know, I've been practicing for hours and hours and hours, that one routine. I practiced it twice with my coach. It went perfect. And, you know, it didn't happen, but that's okay, because the way I see it is there's no place to go but up.
Most of us expose our bodily flaws only in private, behind the closed bathroom door. A good hard look in the mirror, a shrug, and then back into the world with your clothes on. Bodybuilders rely on others to tell them what's not working. Coaches and judges deliver the verdict about where you're coming up short.
Are there specific muscle groups or parts of your body that you're going to try to focus on more?
Yes.
Tell me about that.
You're talking about lagging body parts. Is really what
I wouldn't be so critical.
That's the term we use in the sport, is lagging body parts.
Okay, tell me about your lagging body parts.
Lagging
John.
Body parts. So my lower body does not match my upper body. I'm all legs. So like, honestly. My upper body, especially my chest, needs work.
He's got a plan. He's got time until the next competition, sometime in the spring. For John, the glitches and finishing where he did, it doesn't appear to have tarnished the sport for him.
I could see some people just like quitting and being like, you know what, I'm going to pursue something else.
Well, that's the thing, dude. I'm not that type of person. I'm the type of person where if I could get kicked down, it pisses me off and I want to come back even harder. So, yeah, that's how I roll. I mean, that's just how I do it. Like, I don't just close the door and say, this is impossible. No, I say, it's impossible? No, I think not. And that's it.
Cliche, I know, but what else could you say? Athlete loses the big game, this is what they come up with. You take your lumps and you move on. You work on those lagging body parts. Remember, in bodybuilding, it's diet matches training matches goal. You want your 600-plus muscles to look good next time around, even better than the person next to you? Well, there's only one way to get there, buddy. You gotta hit the gym.
That was reporter Todd Bookman. You can see photos of John McClain on our website, nhpr.org. Up next, Hannah McCarthy and Nick Capodice from Civics 101 tell us about propositions, bills and amendments initiated by the people and voted into law by the people.
If you're from the great state of Idaho, you might have heard this.
It's not just saving our tradition of horse racing. Proposition 1 is about Idaho. Job creation, classroom funding, real accountability. And the Idahoans sponsoring Prop 1 are donating 100% of net profits from their horse racing operations to a new charitable foundation.
I've worked with and owned horses all my life. Supporters of Prop 1 are running deceptive ads. Prop 1 is an unlimited expansion of gambling statewide. I know the people behind Prop 1, and they've made a lot of promises to schools and the racing community, but they take 18 times more money than schools get.
All right, Hannah.
Yes.
Pop quiz hotshot.
Okay.
Yes or no on Prop 1?
I don't know. I don't know what Prop 1 is, and I need more information if I'm going to say
who
yes
benefits,
or no.
Who benefits in Prop 1?
Schools. Right? Schools get money?
4-H?
I cannot explain to you what Prop 1 is. I'm Nick Capodice.
And I'm Hannah McCarthy.
This is Civics 101, the podcast refresher course on the basics of how our whole democracy works. So today we're going to be talking about propositions, ballot measures. These are initiatives, referendums, and recall.
So when you say propositions, what are you talking about?
Propositions is an umbrella term under which initiative, referendum, and recall fall. To be clear, today we're not talking about legislatively referred constitutional amendments, which all the states except for Delaware have.
Hold on, what is up with Delaware?
I don't know, actually. We're going to have to put that in our state anomaly episode along with Nebraska's single house legislature.
And our 400-seat House of Representatives.
Yeah.
Did I sound a little drunk when I said that?
No, it sounded perfect. First off, ballot initiatives, they only happen in 24 states. And when I told our midterm guru, Dan Cassino from Fairleigh Dickinson University, that I thought it was funny that New Hampshire didn't have initiatives, he said that.
No, it's about when your state constitution was written. your state constitution was written between about 1880 and 1915. You're going to have initiative, referendum, recall, all that. If it wasn't written or wasn't revised during that period, you're not going to have it.
This was during the height of the progressive era, when progressives were arguing that corporations, monopolies, and trust were corrupting state legislators, and there was no way for the citizens' voice to be heard. Ballot initiative gives them that voice. So many of you out there, you're not going to see props on your ballot on election day. So for you, this episode is going to make you wish you had them or grateful that you don't. If you are from one of those 24 states, chances are they are a massive part of your political landscape. But first, we need to dissect what an initiative and a referendum are. Here's former California Assembly member and teacher Cheryl Cook Callio.
The initiative and referendum process puts the ability for citizens to either initiate, the word initiate, a statute that can be passed that either becomes a bill or it might become an amendment to a state constitution, which gives grassroots organizers a real advantage.
So an initiative is new legislation initiated by the people.
Yes, and referendum is
something that the legislature submits to the people in order for them to validate a law that they would like to have passed. Oftentimes it is something that's controversial, or it may be like a state constitution, or a referendum could be a grassroots movement by citizens of a particular state or county or city to recall or to redo a bill that they don't want that was passed by their lawmaking body.
So a referendum is either reworking or removing a bill that's already been passed by Congress.
Yeah.
So this gave a lot of power to individual citizens as opposed to leaving it up to your representatives.
And legislative referendum is when elected officials put the question to the people. What do you think? Should we pass this bill?
Why on earth would Congress want the people's opinion instead of just working it out themselves?
Well, as we've learned in many episodes, it's really hard to get bills through both houses of Congress. So if you're a legislator and there's a bill that you think doesn't have a chance of getting out of committee or going through debate on the floor of the House or the Senate, you can just throw it to the people for a vote. And it becomes law.
So yeah, this is Tim Eyman, and I'm part of a team that has done initiatives in Washington State for the last 20 years. And during that time, we've managed to get 16 ballot measures on the ballot during that period of time. And voters have approved 10 of those and rejected six, so we're batting over 500.
Tim is a conservative, and part of what appeals to him about this process is that it gives him a voice in a state that tends to lean pretty blue.
Well, the initiative process is allowing the people to decide, and I think that that's always been attractive to me, because frankly, I just don't trust politicians to do the right thing. But the initiatives we focused on are really focused on limiting government's power, especially when it comes to taxes.
Okay, that's initiative and referendum, but what is recall?
Ooh, recall is super interesting and super duper rare, but I wanted to include it today. Here's another initiative expert, Guy Marzorati, political correspondent from our friends at KQED in San Francisco.
Recalls are of actual politicians and elected officials. We had one a little more than a decade ago in the governor's office where the sitting governor was recalled by voters. And so that, again, was required a signature drive that was then placed on the ballot, and the governor was recalled, and a new governor was chosen in the same election.
The people just removed a governor?
They did. Gray Davis was removed from office in 2003. Mostly due to tax and budget issues. But this was the election when Arnold Schwarzenegger was sworn in as governor.
For the people to win, politics as usual must lose.
No impeachment process, no trial in the Senate, just the voice of the people.
Yes, though I should add, only 19 U.S. states have recall, and there's only been three in U.S. history, two of which were successful.
Okay, so that's recall. How about initiatives and referendums? How did they start? Who can put one on the ballot?
It can be anyone. And, you know, there's a process by which you submit the language to the state. And then after that language is reviewed, you are allowed to start gathering signatures.
So here's Tim Eyman again. This is the guy who's gotten 20 initiatives on the ballot in Washington State.
Well, it's really tough. You've got to somehow convince well over 300,000 fellow citizens to sign a piece of paper to put that idea on the ballot, and you have to do that in about 3 or 4 months. So it's an incredibly difficult process to be able to, you know, essentially start the entire campaign and get it up and running and successful in such a short period of time.
Just a quick check-in, Hannah. How are you feeling about initiatives so far?
In the sense that we are a democracy for the people, by the people, it sounds really great, right?
Well, let's start by looking at those signatures.
Hi, my name is Kathy from Petitions Unlimited. And we're here today in this very, very rough economy, and I got the job for you.
In California, we often see outside of supermarkets and places where a lot of people gather, you'll see folks with clipboards with different initiatives that they are gathering signatures for.
Make your own hours. This is great for a musician, for an actor, somebody that just wants to make money on the side. This is
many of those people who do that are paid to do it, and it can be a lucrative business if, say, an initiative is running against the clock to qualify for a ballot. Maybe its proponents will pay a hefty fee for each, you know, signature that's gathered in order to make sure that the initiative proposal does get on the ballot.
Hold on, it's not just, you know, passionate advocates getting signatures?
No, this is business. Big business.
Enough valid signatures from registered voters and the measures make it to the November ballot.
If you have the 13 or 12 petitions and you get one person to sign them all, it's worth about $40. So it's worth a lot of money.
Some campaigns are paying as much as $5 this year for a single signature. Eileen Ray runs a petition.
It's the person collecting signatures who gets the $5 per signature?
Yeah, so they can make upwards of $500 a day.
So there's no incentive for that person with a clipboard to tell you the truth about what you're signing. So if you're not doing your due diligence, if you're not reading the initiative, you know, yourself.
And they have a whole bag of tricks.
They can walk up and they say, well, you like puppies, don't you? And, you know, this protects the puppies. And, oh, yes, I'm going to sign this because it protects the puppies. Only to find out that it kills kittens.
Their job is really just to get the signatures and get paid for it.
As of October 17th, 2018, Ballotpedia has tracked about $1.4 billion, with a B, dollars spent on contributions and expenditures towards ballot measures for these upcoming midterms.
This is starting to dampen my enthusiasm for a citizen-led democracy.
Well, let me just throw another wet log on the fire, Hannah. Sometimes parties and corporations throw tons of money behind initiatives for other reasons.
Ballot initiatives sometimes are often just used to get people out to the polls. I mean, we saw an example of that this year in California with the gas tax repeal. This was a measure placed on the ballot with heavy funding from the state Republican Party. They spent a lot to get the signatures and get it qualified for the ballot, but then stopped spending as much once the measure actually qualified. And the reason was they really wanted this gas tax repeal on the ballot to get Republicans to the polls. They thought it would be a big driver of turnout that would help them in the governor's race and even more importantly, help them in really close congressional races. But as an actual measure, they didn't really fund it once it was on the ballot to the same extent, which made it seem like maybe it was more important to get it on there than to actually get it passed.
So imagine for a second that we as a nation had initiative and referendum, and that the decision to overturn Roe v. Wade was up to the people to decide. Can you imagine the voter turnout for that election?
I think it would be huge, right? I mean, that's one of the most divisive issues in the country. If that were up to us for a vote, I think most able voters would turn out. But how would you even write that on a ballot?
I am very glad you asked, because this brings me to another point. Since you're voting for ideas as opposed to just candidates' names on a ballot, there is a lot of attention on how these are phrased. Back in 2008, Cheryl Cocalio, she was teaching a high school class she called the most inclusive class she had seen.
They had a gay-straight alliance before other schools had them. The kids were very open about who they were.
And this was when California was voting on Prop 8, which was about same-sex marriage.
We have an iVote thing in California where students mimic the national election, and they all voted against gay marriage. And my mouth flew open, as did my entire We the People class. And I immediately went to the ballot and looked at how it was worded. And I said, well, they were all thought they were voting in favor of gay marriage. So how something is worded is extremely important. And there are lawyers that spend their entire career figuring out how to word something so that it seems like one thing is opposed to another.
The wording is such a politicized aspect of this whole ballot initiative conversation. So the wording is decided by the Attorney General's office, and this, you know, can work very drastically for and against supporters of a ballot measure. Take this year with the gas tax repeal. Democrats control all statewide office in California, which includes the Attorney General's office. So what voters will see on their ballot does not say, do you want to vote yes on a gas tax repeal? Instead, the measure and the language that they'll see seems really tilted towards, do you want to get rid of funding that has been dedicated to fix our roads, to fund transportation, which is what this increased gas tax went towards. So polling, interestingly, that has just asked people about their thoughts on the ballot measure by reading them the ballot language, the repeal has done a lot worse than if you ask people whether they support a repeal of the gas tax.
Well, what language actually made it onto the ballot?
All right, here's the first part for the Prop 6 summary. Repeals a 2017 transportation laws tax and fee provisions that pay for repairs and improvements to local roads, state highways, and public transportation. So Ballotpedia has this automatic formula that analyzes the readability of all of these measures. And it's called the Flesch-Kincaid grade level, which is how many years of formal education you'd have in order to fully understand with confidence a ballot measure. So this one we just read, that scores a 16.
What does 16 mean?
That means you need 16 years of formal education to comprehend it. You need a college degree. And the one we played some ads for in the beginning, our old horsey friend, Prop 1 in Idaho.
I've worked with and owned horses all my life.
53 years of formal education to understand it.
Who besides a monk has 53 years of formal education?
It's just a formula that analyzes language. But tell me how you'd vote on this. Ready?
Yeah.
An initiative amending Chapter 25, Title 54, Idaho Code contains findings and purposes, amends definition of historical horse race, adds new section authorizing historical horse race betting at certain locations where live or simulcast paramutual horse race betting occurs, specifies requirements for historical horse race terminals, declares such terminals not to be slot machines, allocates revenue from historical horse race betting, requires licensees to enter into agreements with horsemen's groups, creates historical horse race purse monies fund in state treasury, authorizes distribution by state racing commission and investment by state treasurer fund monies, directs state racing commission to promulgate implementing rules, declares an act effective upon voter approval and completion of voting canvass, and provides for severability.
Get out. Leave.
My favorite words in this are spell check was like, don't you mean something else? Like three words in this, my spell check didn't catch.
What's the single thing I'm voting on? Like, what's the big idea here? Because these are a million little things that don't mean a hell of a lot to me because I know nothing about horse racing.
Yeah, this is the sort of stuff that requires you to do the legwork. You have to research each initiative before you vote. From what I can gather, Prop 1 is about legalizing the use of video terminals for horse race betting.
I would not have gotten that.
And there's 11 of these in California alone. So if there's a call to action today, it's to go to a website like ballotpedia.org, put in your address, and get a sample ballot before Election Day.
Or let's say you're in the polling booth. Get out your phone. Look this stuff up if you need to.
So let's hear Guy's final thoughts on the pros and cons of direct democracy.
Supporters of ballot initiatives say this is the best way to give citizens power to react to things that the legislature isn't dealing with. Examples of that in the past have been about property taxes and this year rent control, issues that the legislature hasn't taken up for years. People are fed up and they feel like, okay, you didn't act on this, now it's time for us to act on it. On the flip side, when we talk about citizens' initiatives, these often aren't brought to the ballot by, you know, some good citizen who suddenly thinks of an idea that should be a law. It's oftentimes interest groups, unions, corporations that feel like, you know, they want to change a law. They couldn't do it through the legislature. They don't want to negotiate about it. They want to just put forward kind of a yes or no idea, and they're willing to spend heavily to make it happen. That's, you know, how this this process, I guess, has taken on more of a cynical aspect.
And if it seems that people are a bit cynical of initiatives, I want to close by saying that, yes, corporations and political parties have massive influence on what initiatives make it to the ballot. That said, these are also the issues that elected officials have been avoiding, that they wouldn't touch with a 10-foot pole. Issues like marijuana legalization, abortion, same-sex marriage, the death penalty.
So knowing that the language might be designed to purposefully obfuscate the meaning, I feel empowered to do research and also to take with a grain of salt what I'm reading in that voting booth. It's a little bit like those crosswords you do, Nick, where the clue contains the answer, but it's not immediately apparent. You have to think outside the box to get to it.
The cryptic crossword.
Yeah.
And I think they're really exciting. They just put out, it's a lot of, there's a lot of trust in the voter in these issues.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if the voters all do their work,
yeah,
then these can be a really cool thing. If they don't, they are at the whims of people who have lots of money.
Right.
So you're going to move to California?
No.
Okay.
I like the rain.
Before we go, we have our final snapshot of a famous midterm from U.S. history, delivered by former NHPR reporter, current afternoon host at Wisconsin Public Radio, author of Dead Presidents, Mr. Perfect, Brady Carlson. What midterm are we talking about today, Brady?
We're talking about the midterm of 2002, and the lesson from this midterm is that the rules of American politics only apply until they don't. We know that what typically happens in midterms is that the president's party loses seats in Congress in the midterm after the president is first elected. They don't always vote for the opposition party to have control of Congress, but at the very least, the president's party ends up with fewer seats in Congress after that midterm. That said, the political picture in 2002 was complicated. We were only a couple years removed from the presidential election of 2000. That's the one where Republican George W. Bush won the Electoral College but lost the popular vote, and there was the highly controversial Supreme Court decision about recounts in the state of Florida.
Neither the sanctity of the ballots nor the integrity of the election has been compromised, and that the election results...
Republicans had a majority in the House of Representatives. It was a straightforward majority. The Senate was anything but straightforward. The 2000 elections had left the chamber with 50 Republican senators and 50 Democratic and Democratic-aligned senators, so the vice president was on the hook to potentially break all these ties. And then, after 5 months of that split, a Republican senator switched parties, and the Democrats had a very narrow majority.
I have found myself increasingly at odds with the Republican philosophy and more in line with the philosophy of the Democratic Party.
So leading up to this midterm, we had one chamber of Congress with a Republican majority, one with a Democratic majority, a president who had only narrowly won an election. So this is about as divided government gets, which in and of itself is very complicated. But of course, the most complicated piece of the midterm in 2002 was that it came about a year after the attacks of September 11, 2001.
I became something that no president should ever want to be, a wartime president.
There were other issues at the time. There had been a big tax cut bill in Congress. There was the No Child Left Behind education law. The U.S. economy had kind of become sluggish. But the single big issue in this midterm was security. The U.S. was already launching a military effort in Afghanistan. President Bush had called for Congress to authorize a new military campaign in Iraq. And I had forgotten until I looked it up just how close to the election the Iraq war vote took place. It was in October 2002, so it was under a month before Election Day. Republicans in Congress, by and large, backed the president and said, we need to go into Iraq. The Democrats, who had mostly opposed the president on the economy and other domestic issues, ended up split on the Iraq vote. A lot of rank-and-file Democrats opposed the war vote, but their leaders in the House and Senate, as well as some very high-profile senators like Hillary Clinton and John Kerry, voted in favor of the resolution.
Any vote that might lead to war should be hard. But I cast it with conviction.
Now, obviously, that became a very consequential vote for a lot of reasons. A lot of people changed their minds about that vote in the years to come. But if you look at it purely through the lens of a midterm election campaign, you have a lot of high-profile Democrats who are basically siding with the Republican administration on the top issue of the campaign. And all of that ends up leading to a midterm outcome which is far from the usual. There's an important caveat about that rule that the president's party loses seats in the president's first midterm. And that is that you can usually track how big those losses are going to be for the president's party based on the president's approval rating at the time. So take George W. Bush's predecessor, Bill Clinton. In his first midterm election, his approval rating was like 43%, and so Democrats lost pretty big. They lost control of Congress. In 2002, George W. Bush's approval rating was 63%.
We choose freedom and the dignity of every life.
It wasn't that long before it was even higher in the immediate aftermath of the September 11th attacks. So you have a president with relatively high approval ratings, long-term changes in the country's political alignment, and an election where security and terrorism are top issues in a way that they usually aren't. And it wasn't that all of that ended up turning into a landslide for Republicans in 2002. It was still pretty divided if you look at the raw vote totals. But the races that might have swung one way or another and determined the outcome wound up swinging in the administration's favor. So in the end, Republicans gained 5 seats in the House, they gained 2 in the Senate. So they wound up having majorities in both chambers of Congress again. This is the first time that the president's party had gained seats in the president's first midterm election since the 1930s.
He told me to come down here and tell y'all something. He told me to come down here and tell you that 2 years from now, he wants all of y'all on his team.
The lesson here is that there are no guarantees in U.S. elections. There are trends, and some of them happen so often that they might almost feel like political laws. But to assume that voters will go a certain way in an election just because voters have usually gone that certain way in the past is to forget the wisdom of one of our great philosophers, baseball star Yogi Berra, who said, "It ain't over till it's over."
That's all for this week's show. Word of Mouth was produced by me, Erica Janik, with Todd Bookman, Nick Capodice, and Hannah McCarthy. Our staff includes Justine Paradise, Jimmy Gutierrez, and Ben Henry. Do you have a question about New Hampshire? We're always looking for stories. Whether you're a lifelong Granite Stater or you're a transplant just settling in, chances are you've probably encountered something like this. You're driving along some stretch of I-93 or walking on a trail in the White Mountains, and suddenly you notice something that made you wonder, what's up with that? Maybe it's been, how did that statue get there? And what did that person do to deserve a statue in the first place? Or maybe, why are some of our road signs in kilometers? No matter what you're wondering, we want to know. What questions do you have about New Hampshire? Send us your questions and we might be able to track down an answer. They can be large or small, silly or serious. All questions are welcome. Chances are, yours could end up sparking a pretty interesting follow-up investigation. Sometimes the very best stories are hiding in plain sight.
leave us a message at 603-513-7796 or send us an email at wordofmouth@nhpr.org. We can't wait to hear from you. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.